I'd like to welcome everyone to today's web seminar. This is part of the Risky Learning web seminar series sponsored by the NIEHS Superfund Basic Research Program. Today's seminar is titled Phytostabilization of Mine Tailings in Arid and Semi-Arid Environments. Dr. Raina Mayer from the University of Arizona is today's presenter. I'd like now to introduce Monica Ramirez, also from the University of Arizona, to offer a brief introduction on today's seminar and to introduce Dr. Mayer. Monica?
Thank you, Larry. So once again, my name is Monica Ramirez, and I'm the Research Translation Coordinator for the U of A Superfund Basic Research Program in Tucson, Arizona. The overall goals of our Research Translation Corps is to actively communicate the research products generated by our Superfund program to pertinent audiences and stakeholders. With that said, Region 9 Hazardous Technical Substances liaison Mike Gill and I have designed a seminar series that has two parts. The first part is called Live at Region 9, where our U of A investigators present at Region 9 headquarters. And the second part includes the Internet seminar, which we're about to hear, that incorporates input from the live presentation. In addition, we have a live and local audience in the room with us today. And today we'll be hearing, as you heard, on phytostabilization of mine tailings in arid and semi-arid environments. And next we'll focus on DNAPLs in the following 3 months. Without further ado, I'd like to introduce Raina Mayer, Professor of Environmental Microbiology in the Department of Soil, Water, and Environmental Sciences here at the University of Arizona. She currently serves as the Associate Director of the University of Arizona Superfund Basic Research Program. Dr. Mayer received her PhD in microbiology from Rutgers University and was a postdoctoral research associate in biochemistry at Iowa State University. Dr. Mayer's research is interdisciplinary and is focused on developing a fundamental understanding of the biological factors and processes that influence the transport and fate of both microorganisms and chemical contaminants in the environment. The information gained from this research is used in the development of innovative remediation approaches, which can be tested at a range of scales from pore scale to the field scale. Recent research has focused on the ability of bacteria to survive and metabolize in extremely allotrophic environments. And Dr. Mayer is seeking patterns in diversity and community structure of bacteria in a variety of allotrophic environments, including subsurface soils, Sonoran desert soils, cave environments, and mine tailing sites in southern Arizona. Dr. Mayer has over 90 scientific publications representing this work, and I'm happy to introduce her today.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Larry, and thank you, Monica, for the great introduction. Also, thank you to NIEHS and EPA for setting up this seminar. And, of course, thank you to all the participants who are taking their time to listen. As was introduced already, I'll be talking about phytostabilization of mine tailings specifically in arid and semi-arid environments. Go to slide 2, please. As shown in this slide, in the picture on the right, there are two major problems associated with the mining industry, which, by the way, is a historic industry. Mining started over 5,000 years ago. So this is not a new problem, but as our communities grow and begin encroaching on these mine tailing sites, they're becoming more and more pressing problems as well. So in this picture on the right, we can see the two problems associated with mine tailings, that of acid mine drainage, which is the acidic metal-containing effluent coming from the tailings that goes into local streams and water bodies. And in the background, you can see the mine tailings and waste rock piles, and these materials are subject to wind and water erosion. Go to slide 3, please. This map is a map of the abandoned mine tailing sites in the U.S., and you can see there are two concentrations of these sites, one on the East Coast and one in the West. In the East Coast, the primary problem associated with mine tailings is acid mine drainage. Acid mine drainage is estimated to affect over 10,000 miles of waterways in the East. However, in the West, while acid mine drainage also occurs, perhaps the larger problem is that of the mine tailings themselves. And in this arid environment, the fact that they are blown around by wind and also are subject to water erosion from large rainfall events. Go to slide 4, please. So these two pictures illustrate both winds and water erosion really well. On the right is a mine tailings pile on a windy day, and you can see that these particulates are moving a great distance. These can be associated with acidic conditions. Some of them have high metal content, and in addition, they contribute to the PM2.5 and PM10 particulates. On the left, we see what water erosion can do. This mine tailing site is adjacent to the San Pedro River, and when we have our monsoon rains, the river fills up and actually cuts the mine tailings out and carries them downriver. Go to slide 5, please. So what are possible health impacts? Rupture exposure really includes inhalation of the dust particulates and direct ingestion of soil, particularly by children. Metals of concern probably primarily include lead and arsenic from mine tailings. Go to slide 6, please. I'm going to show you a series of pictures just to illustrate this problem. This is the mine tailings in Villa de la Paz. We visited about a month ago, and it was extremely impressive to see. This community is built on the tailings. The children's school is on the tailings. The children play in the tailings. These tailings have up to 6% lead after mining. This is the same tailings pile taken from a different perspective on a windy day, and you can see the wind being blown over the community. Indeed, the children in the community have elevated blood lead levels. This is a picture of the Villa de la Paz tailings impoundment, and you can see to the right, about 10 or 15 kilometers downstream, is a little town called Cerrito Blanco. There the children play in the stream, which has elevated levels of arsenic from these mine tailings. Go to slide, we're on slide 9 now. Please go to slide 10. This is a second site in Mexico that we're actually going to be doing some field work at, called the Nacazari tailings site. Here the tailings are highly unstable, as you can see, and the danger includes collapse onto nearby buildings. Go to slide 11, please. Of course, mine tailing sites are not only in Mexico. We have our own right here at home. This is a site near Tucson, owned by Phelps Dodge. In fact, it's in Green Valley, Arizona. They have 1,800 acres of tailings, and on the right you can see some of the erosion that has gone on. This is a Google Earth map photo of the site. And what I'd like you to look at is the town of Green Valley, which is encroaching on the site. It's less than a kilometer away. And this is a town primarily of retired citizens who are starting to complain about the dust being generated from the site, which was actually there before the town was built. Go to slide 13, please. So what are the common characteristics of tailings found in arid and semi-arid environments? Historic mine tailings generally have quite high metal concentrations, but modern tailings are mined much more efficiently, so many of the modern tailings, including the Phelps Dodge site that you just saw, have very low levels of metals. In addition, the pH can range from very acidic to neutral and slightly alkaline, and that's due to the presence of a large buffering capacity due to carbonate in the soil and rock. However, these mine tailings share a couple of properties. They do not have organic matter. They do not have nutrients. They do not have any soil structure, which means they have very, very low water holding capacity. And as a result, They have severely impacted microbial communities, and they are barren of vegetation. And they remain barren of vegetation, sometimes for hundreds of years. And so the question that we're asking in our research is whether these sites can be revegetated, and what is it going to take to revegetate these sites? Go to slide 14, please. So if you want to revegetate, that is a type of phytoremediation. And I want to explain there's actually two different forms of phytoremediation. The first is phytoextraction, where you have a plant, and the goal is to take up the metal from the soil into the above-ground plant tissue. Then you can harvest the plant and actually remove metal from the site. For mine tailings, that's not a terribly practical approach. We've calculated it would take hundreds of crops in order to actually extract all the metals from some of these historic sites. So we're looking at a second type of phytoremediation called phytostabilization. And that's where we use the plant to stabilize the metals in situ. And that's done through a combination of root exudates and bacteria that grow in the rhizosphere of these roots that causes the metals to precipitate and become stable. In addition, the plant prevents both wind and water erosion. Go to slide 15, please. So what are the considerations for phytostabilization? There are several. First, plant criteria. Really, you should focus on the use of native plants, depending on whatever region you're in, and use a mix of grasses, shrubs, and trees so that you can get different types of rooting masses, some deep, some shallow, some thicker, and perhaps some a little bit thinner. But this combination will help to stabilize the tailings better than a single plant. The plants should be drought tolerant, they should be metal tolerant, and they should be salt tolerant. A lot of these sites are very high in salt. Okay, these sites have been barren for a very long time, and so we have to face the fact that in most cases, amendments are required for revegetation. These amendments can be inorganic, including fertilizers or lime to increase the pH. Inorganic amendments tend to last a very short time, and so we have been focusing more on organic amendments, which include either the addition of biosolids or the addition of compost. What these do are to immediately increase the pH of acidic mine tailings. They improve the physical structure and water holding capacity. They provide slow release nutrient source, and they provide for immediate compactation of heavy metals, which may be providing toxicity. Go to slide 16, please. One also must take into account the metal accumulation into the plant. We don't want to choose plants where there will be elevated shoot accumulation because we don't want exposure either to foraging animals or to humans that might come in contact with the tailings. In addition, we have to remember that there will be plant turnover, and if metals are in shoot tissue, that plant turnover will add it to the top of the soil. Finally, we have to consider what the long-term state of metals is in the tailings. Does the speciation of the tailings metals in the rhizosphere change, either in the short term if you're establishing the plant or over the long term? And what impact might that change, if there is one, have on metal mobility and bioavailability? Very, very little information is available on this topic, and we're just beginning to look at it, so I don't have any answers on this yet. Hopefully next time I do a seminar. So I'm going to now go into two case studies that we've done. And the first case study, go to slide 17, please, is a historic acidic lead-zinc mine tailing called the Klondike site. This is next to Aravaipa Creek, which is one of the two important riparian areas in southern Arizona. It was a lead and zinc ore processing operation from 1948 to 1958. Go to slide 18, please. The pH ranges from very acidic, pH 2, to moderately acidic. The metal concentrations range up to 2% for lead. Arsenic is not very high, but copper and zinc are also elevated. This is considered a hazardous waste because Arizona soil remediation levels are 1,200 milligrams per kilogram of lead. The heterotrophic bacterial counts in this soil, in this, these tailings, are less than 100 colony-forming units per gram. Now, let me put that in perspective for you. A normal soil in a semi-arid environment like this has somewhere between a million and 10 million, 10 to the 6 to 10 to the 7 CFU per gram. So this low, low number indicates the level of stress in these tailings. Further, if you look at autotrophic counts, specifically iron and sulfur oxidizers, they range between 10 to the 4 and 10 to the 5 colony-forming units per gram. This is in comparison to a normal soil where you cannot recover these organisms at all, again, indicating the stress level at the site. Please go to slide 19. So we began by doing a screening study of native plants, starting with about 15 plants. And the list on this slide are the plants that grew in these Klondike tailings with the aid of compost. The remaining plants did not even grow. And for the remainder of the talk, I'm going to focus primarily on Atroplex, and there's an Atroplex plant shown at the right, and also talk a little bit about a plant we're quite excited about right now called buffalo grass, not to be confused with the invasive species called buffle grass. So buffalo grass is good, buffle grass is bad. Okay, go to slide 20, please. I want to give you the results of the greenhouse study that we did, which was to look at how much compost do you need to establish Atroplex in the Klondike tailings. And the answer is somewhere between 10 and 15% by weight. Go to slide 21, please. Now, these are the data that support that conclusion I just told you. This is a pretty complex slide, and it's hard without a pointer, but I'm going to try. We looked at two tailing samples from the site, a very acidic pH 3 sample called K4 and a moderately acidic pH 6 sample called K6. On the x-axis, the number following the K4 or K6 indicates the percent of tailing. So it goes from 75 to 85 to 90 to 95 to 100% tailing. The rest is made up by compost. So K475 is 75% tailings and 25% compost. In addition, there's an OS offsite control and a CC compost control. Go to slide 22, please. I've put yellow rectangles around the treatments that are statistically the same as the offsite control. And what you see is that the 10%, 15%, and 25% compost rates are statistically the same as the control. Go to slide 23, please. These two pictures just give a visual example of these results. So in the upper left-hand corner is the K4, very acidic sample with 5% compost, and you can see how stunted that plant is. On the picture on the right, we're comparing the K4 sample with 10% compost, 15% compost with the compost control. Although these weren't statistically different, you can see that the 10% compost plant doesn't look quite as good as the 15%, and that's where we get our conclusion that somewhere between 10 and 15% is the rate required to get this plant to grow normally on the tailings. Go to slide 24, please. So, in addition, we looked at what happened to the tailings immediately after we added compost. we saw an increase in pH, we saw an increase in organic carbon and nitrogen, we saw increased heterotrophic bacterial counts. After the study was over, we looked at the plant tissue. We saw no accumulation of lead, copper, cadmium, or arsenic in the shoot material. And finally, we did a microbial community analysis to try and indicate the level of disturbance. Now, I'm going to give you my first conclusions for the talk from this slide, and that is that compost amendments, be it small or large, you can find a compost amendment rate that will allow you to establish plants in any mine tailings, because this is about as bad as you get. Okay, so that's conclusion number one. Now I'd like to talk a little bit about the microbial community analysis that we did. This microbial community analysis was done on the tailings before plant establishment. Go to slide 25, please. What we did was to extract the community DNA from the tailing sample and analyze what bacteria were present. So it's not culture-based. It's just based on the DNA that's there. And when you do an analysis like this, what you get is what's called a clone library. What we found in the pH 3K4 sample was that we were able to get, look in the yellow rectangle, we were able to get 8 clones, meaning 8 different types of bacteria. And just to remind you, the culturable counts were less than 10 colony-forming units per gram. The autotrophic iron and sulfur oxidizers were 10 to the fifth per gram. We found that these 8 different clones represented 4 different divisions of bacteria. None of these clones were obligate heterotrophs. That means they all could work autotrophically and oxidize either iron or sulfur. Go to slide 26, please. This is the moderately acidic sample, K6. 200 culturable organisms per gram and about 10 to the fifth autotrophs per gram. We increased the number of bacteria recovered in the clone study from 8 to 24 in the K6 sample. And you can see that we increased the number of divisions of bacteria that we recovered. Also, we now have 25% of these clones being obligate heterotrophs. Go to slide 27, please. Finally, we did a clone library of an off-site control soil adjacent to the tailings pile. Here, the culturable counts were about 10 to the 6th CFU per gram, and the autotrophic counts were below detection limits. Our clone library had 42 clones compared to 24 compared to 8 for the tailings samples. And now we've got 10 different bacterial divisions represented, and actually this representation is very similar to what you find in any soil that you look at. Also, 88% of these clones, the vast majority of these clones, were obligate heterotrophs, indicating a healthy soil. Go to slide 28, please. This is another way to look at the data I just presented. These are called phylogenetic trees, and I want to compare the tree on the left, which is represents the K4 and K6 sample, with the one on the right, which is the off-site control sample. There are no bacteria shared between the off-site tree and the K4, K6 tree. There is no similarity between them. However, the K4 organisms, 57% of them are found in the K6 sample, indicating they're sort of a subset of the K6 sample. And there's a great deal of similarity. Go to slide 29, please. If you look at the clones that are shared between the K4 and K6 samples, on the right in red, there are a couple of iron oxidizers and a couple of organisms that can oxidize either iron or sulfur. Okay, so these are the autotrophs. Go to slide 30. In blue are shown organisms that are commonly found and reported from acid mine drainage and other mine tailings. Again, all involved in iron and sulfur oxidation, indicating that the vast majority of these organisms in the K4 and K6 sample are operating to oxidize iron and sulfur and create acidic conditions at the site. Go to slide 31, please. So, the question that we are posing is that if the iron and sulfur oxidizers are responsible for creating the acid environment found in the tailings and in acid mine drainage, and if they prevent normal soil formation processes, can we use heterotrophic microorganisms to help restore normal soil formation functions and establish a vegetative cap? Go to slide 32, please. So we have become very interested in looking at plant growth promoting bacteria to enhance the phytostabilization process. Plant growth promoting bacteria establish mutualistic relationships with plants. They provide nutrients in the form of nitrogen, phosphate, and iron. They provide hormones and growth factors like indole acetic acid and ACC deaminase. They've been well studied in the literature, especially for agriculture, and they're used in agriculture. They are being now used to help restore desertified sites. There have been a very few studies in metal-contaminated soils using agricultural PGPBs. However, to the best of our knowledge, there are no studies using these organisms in mine tailings. And so we decided to try to investigate plant growth-promoting bacteria for mine tailings. And one of my students made a collection of 130 microorganisms that he collected from mine tailings and from the rhizospheres of roots growing in mine tailings. And he investigated which of these microorganisms had plant growth promoting activities. And from this collection of 130 isolates, he narrowed it down to 20, which looked the most promising based on their different activities, and did some greenhouse experiments where he inoculated seeds and looked at whether they helped the plants grow. And so the next three slides that I'm going to show you are the results from these greenhouse studies. So go to slide 33. This slide on the x-axis shows each isolate that was tested, and on the y-axis is biomass. This is, the plant is Atroplex. It was grown in the Klondike tailings with 0% compost. And remember, the plants are very, very stunted in 0% compost. First of all, the average survival out of 10 seeds planted per treatment was low. It was only 5 seeds per treatment. But what I'd like to point out is there was one organism, SP1, see the green arrow, that improved biomass production by 400%, statistically improved. And there were two more in this study, K611B and MTR71, that improved the survivability of the plant from 5 to 8. So we look at all three of these organisms as promising. Go to slide 34. This is the same experiment but done with 10% compost. Remember, 10% compost is just at the limit of the level that you need to get good growth in the Klondike tailings. Here we saw a much better average survival of about 8 seeds per treatment out of 10. And here we found 4 isolates, MTR1, MTR11, MTR18, and MTR21A, were able to enhance biomass production significantly by 200 to 250%. Go to slide 35, please. I told you to talk a little bit about buffalo grass, and we're very, very excited about this grass because it's got a really nice, thick root biomass that we think is going to be really effective in helping to stabilize tailings. And we've also found that buffalo grass is even more tolerant of harsh conditions in the tailings than Atriplex. So this is the result of a study done on buffalo grass in the Klondike tailings with 0% compost. We have found that some of these plant growth promoting bacteria perform well over and over in each experiment. And so we tested 6 of these isolates and found 4 of them in this study statistically improved the production of plant biomass by 150 to 190%. So I'm now going to give you conclusion 2 from the study. And that is that we believe that plant growth promoting bacteria have really good potential to aid in plant establishment and perhaps even reduce the compost requirements for plant establishment, which is one of the most expensive parts of the phytoremediation strategy. Go to slide 36, please. I'd like to talk to you a little bit about a second case study that we've done. This is a neutral pH silver gold mine tailing site called the Boston Mill site. This site is on the San Pedro River, which is the second important riparian area in southern Arizona. This site was mined for gold and silver from 1879 to 1887. The metal levels are similar to those that I described for the Klondike site, but the heterotrophic counts are much, much higher, about 10 to the 5th colony-forming units per gram, probably because the pH is not acidic. And plants after 100 years are beginning to encroach at the site. Because this site we felt was less impacted, we actually immediately started a field trial at the site using Atriplex transplants to ask the question whether or not compost was required to establish the plants. Go to slide 37, please. This is a picture of the site. We established 8 plots, 4 with compost and 4 without. You can see 4 of them at each arrow here. Each plot had 5 transplants. Go to slide 38, please. The results showed that 80% of the transplants survived. The biomass increased significantly. You can see in the 2 pictures the transplant and in the bottom the shrub after, I think this is after 6 or 7 months. There was no difference in growth between the compost and no compost treatment in this neutral pH site. And again, we monitored the bacterial community to indicate plant and soil health. Go to slide 39, please. We monitored the community in 2 ways. The first was simply doing heterotrophic counts. And what we can see is that in the absence of plants, the counts range between 10 to the 5 and 10 to the 6 CFU per gram. But with plants, we had a 1 to 2 log increase, and at the end of the study, the counts were ranging above 10 to the 7 CFU per gram. Go to slide 40, please. We then did analysis of the microbial community based on DNA. This is a denaturing gradient gel electrophoresis analysis of the microbial community. Each lane here is the profile from one of the treatments. For example, NC1 is no compost plot 1. C1 is compost plot 1. In each of these profiles, each band theoretically represents 1 bacterial population. Now, you can statistically analyze this gel and get the following information shown in slide 41. Here, we've taken a gel constructed for each time point, 0, 3, 5, 7, 11, and 13 months, and compared the compost, non-compost treatments with unplanted control. And to make it easier for you to see, I put orange squares where the unplanted controls are. So at 0 months, we see there are three statistically different groups, but they don't make any sense. They've got some compost, some no compost, and then the unplanted control is in there. So at 3 months, we see everything's moved around and we can't make any statistical groups. But at 5 months, the pattern emerges. Now, the unplanted controls have statistically separated from the planted treatments. At 7 months, this pattern remains, although it's not statistically significant. We call it a trend. At 11 months, it's statistically significant again. And at 13 months, we added two more unplanted controls, and the separation remains. Note that the largest changes in this pattern came between 0 and 3 and 3 and 5 months, when the plants were really establishing themselves. So again, from these data, we ask, are there microbial isolates that can enhance plant establishment? Because these data suggest that there are microbial communities associated with healthy plants. All right, I'd also like to give conclusion 3 with this slide, and that is that the initial site conditions in terms of pH and in terms of heterotrophic count provide excellent clues for what will be needed for plant establishment. Will you need compost, and how much compost will you need? Go to slide 42, please. So, our future work, what we're doing right now is investigating other isolates in collaboration with co-investigators, also looking at fungi, mycorrhizae. We're looking at a variety of different native plants. One really interesting thing is that we're looking at different inoculation methods for our plant growth promoting bacteria, including encapsulating them into alginate beads, which allows them to withstand the initial toxic conditions in the tailings and survive much longer. So actually, we're seeing real promise with these beads. We're doing isolate tracking, so how long do our plant growth promoting bacteria last in the site? We're continuing to look at community structure and that what that means in interpreting the success of phytostabilization at a site. We're also bringing this from the greenhouse into the field with studies hopefully in the future at Klondike, at Nakazari, and also at the Phelps Dodge site that I showed you. Go to slide 43, please. So this is a summary slide, although I've already given you many of the conclusions as we went along. Native plants do show good potential for revegetation. Amendment of organic matter allows successful plant establishment, but again, the amount required depends on site conditions. Now, in tailings, before treatment, heterotrophic counts are very low and autotrophic counts are very high, indicating a very stressed and disturbed site. In the tailings after treatment, an increase and change occurs in the heterotrophic community that coincides with successful plant establishment, and I believe can be used as biomarkers for successful plant establishment. I would like to emphasize here as well the need for long-term studies. Many of the studies that have been done have only been done for a year or maybe 2 years. We need some 5- and 10-year studies to show what is the longevity of plants on these sites, especially in arid and semi-arid environments, and what happens to metal speciation of the metals within the site over this time frame. Also, we expect that plants will come into the site in a successional manner, naturally, after we establish them. Some of these plants could be shoot accumulating plants. The question is, do the initial plants we put in the site speciate the metals such that they precipitate and are not available for other plants that come in that may be shoot accumulating. So these are some of the things that need to be looked at over the long term in some of these studies. Slide 44, please. This, by the way, is the San Pedro Boston Mill site. The Bureau of Land Management, which manages this site, was very pleased with our field trial here, and they actually had to move some tailings over the railroad tracks and onto the middle that you're seeing here. They then covered it with 6 inches of topsoil, and in June of 2006, we went in to seed the entire site. That center area is where we were trying some plant growth promoting bacteria experiments. Go to slide 12. Let me just tell you, about 2 weeks after we planted this, we had a 20-year rain event, which sort of took out the site. All of the seeds and everything from the north half of the tailings pile were washed onto the south half. So we've actually gone in this year and reseeded the northern half of the site. In slide 45, I just showed some pictures of after the big rain event, and you can see the huge erosion that went on in that is apparent in October and January. Slide 46, please. I also just want to mention that our Superfund Basic Research Program does not only do basic research, we try and translate our research. It's part of our mission. We have been very involved in holding community meetings to help educate the public about mine tailings and exposure routes. We are trying to translate our research from the greenhouse and lab scale to the field by doing field trials. And we've been working with Mexican universities, Mexican partners, to test these strategies in sites across the border. And if you looked at any of those pictures showing the wind movement of these tailings, you know that the borders don't prevent movement. Go to slide 47, please. I would like to acknowledge specifically three people here. Chris Grandlick did all the plant growth promoting studies. Karina Rosario did the Boston Mill field trial. And Monica Mendez did all the initial compost studies in the Klondike soil and the clone studies that I showed you. Thank you very much for your attention, and I would be pleased to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Dr. Mayer. We'd like to move into question and answer period pretty quickly here, but let me mention one thing that I forgot to mention at the beginning of the seminar today. If you follow the link on the very last slide or the home button at the top of the slides, if you're looking at the internet versions, on the home page you'll see a link to a feedback form. Please use this form and give us some feedback on today's seminar and also on any of the other risky learning seminars that we put on through ClueIn. We'll take questions from both the phone participants and the internet participants, or anyone else looking at the slides on the internet can submit questions using the question mark button at the top of each slide. We have a few questions submitted, but I'd like to start with Monica and the group that you have assembled in the room there with Dr. Mayer. Are there any questions from you or from those in the room there that we could start with?
Yeah, I have a few questions. My first question is, I'm wondering how the compost, if a tailing site needs to be composted based on pH, how do you mix that in? How are these studies mixed in?
You can do it with heavy equipment.
So it is mixed in. It's not just laid on top.
It's not just laid on top. It is mixed in. That's correct.
Okay. And then my next question is, I know you mentioned at the end of your presentation that you would like 5 10-year studies, and so maybe that would go to answer this question. but I'm wondering, do the amendments need to be added again and again?
There is some evidence, and it's, I haven't seen it in the literature, but I've heard it word of mouth, that for biosolids, you have to add again and again, because in biosolids, the nutrients are very available and used up very, very quickly. But if you use a compost instead of biosolids, it's a much more long-term source of nutrients, much more slowly released.
Okay.
And so that is an advantage. But I really can't speak for longer than two years or so.
Right. That's basically some of the questions I had for now.
Okay, anything else from those in the room with Dr. Mayer?
No.
Okay, let me. We'll go to the phone participants in just one moment, but let me start off with one question that's been submitted by one of our Internet participants. You mentioned early in this, this is from Ellen Pyatt in UC Davis. You mentioned early in the seminar that modern-day recoveries of metals are very good, so that modern-day tailings do not present the problems of the legacy contamination of old tailings piles. Is there a movement or political will to apply these modern mining methods to old tailings, either in arid areas or in areas such as the Clark Fork River in Montana, where soils and sediments are heavily contaminated?
That's a great question, and the answer is they do it if it's economical. For example, the Boston Mill site that I talked about actually was extracted twice, and it still has fairly high levels of metals. But a company will only go in if it's profitable for them to extract the metals out again. So that's sort of the answer to your question.
Okay. Let's check with our phone participants. If you have a question, please go ahead and take your phone off mute, but please introduce yourself and name your organization.
This is Eugenia McNaughton, Region 9 EPA. I just have a question about what do you do about the fact of flash flooding in the summer? So how do you address that with this project?
Flash flooding is really hard, and if you have a 20-year rainfall event, it's pretty tough. But I'll tell you this. If you can successfully revegetate a site and get, you know, a good plant cover on it, it will even withstand some flash flooding. What people are also realizing is that if these tailings are in an area where they're going to be subject to flash floods, if they're right adjacent to a stream or a creek, you may have to come in with heavy equipment and move them out of that flood zone. For example, they did that at the Boston Mill site. The tailings that were right adjacent to the creek, that's shown in my first slide, if you want to take a look at it, and I think in the third slide again, they actually came in with heavy equipment and moved all of those tailings over the railroad track and joined them with another tailings pile. So if they are in a flash flood area that you cannot control at all, you have to move them out of it. If they're in sort of an area that gets maybe a lot of rain but won't get the flash flood, you can leave them and revegetate, and it should do pretty well.
That brings up a question from my end. When is the best time to plant?
Okay, the best time to plant is usually starting in February, and you shouldn't start planting after probably September, October. So your window is somewhere between February and September, October. And again, I'm talking in Arizona. You're going to have to relook at that probably for the more northern western states.
Right.
Thank you. Let's stay with the phone participants. If you have a question for Dr. Mayer, go ahead and take your phone off mute, and please introduce yourself and name your organization.
Hi, Hi, this is Jenny Phillips from EPA headquarters, and I have a question on if you have any observations through your field trials on the rooting depth of the plants versus the compost mix depth. And what I'm wondering is, are those roots getting below that compost mix depth into the more concentrated tailings? And if so, do you have a suggested kind of a depth that you need to add the compost in to keep that good cover going?
That is a super question, and I'm sorry that I can't answer it yet. That is something we need the longer-term studies done on. But that is, we're looking at that.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let me read a question submitted by Clint Worden, CDM, Denver, Colorado. Did you see similar root growth spatial development between the pH 4 and the pH 6 with differing above ground plant height results seen on slide 23?
That's another great question, and I have to say that we actually measured root biomass and shoot biomass separately, and we did see differences in root biomass, the root-to-shoot biomass ratios. In the plants that were struggling in the lower pH tailings, they had to put more of their energy into the root biomass. So there, proportionally, there was more root biomass than shoot biomass. But if you looked at the overall biomass of the plants grown for the same amount of time in the acidic tailings and the moderately acidic tailings, the overall biomass was lower in the acidic tailings. So it's lower biomass and more of the plant energy goes into the roots, trying to find nutrients and places that they can establish.
Okay, thank you. I have another question here I'd like to read from, forgive me on this name, this is from Marie Pitignano, from New York, New York. Over what period of time is shoot accumulation typically measured?
We generally measured shoot accumulation at the end of the studies. So, for example, on the San Pedro, at the Boston Mill site, we measured shoot accumulation at 18 months. That was the end of that study. In the greenhouse studies, we measure at the end of the study, which is generally about 90 days.
Thank you. Let's check back with our phone participants. Anyone has a question for Dr. Mayer, please take your phone off mute and introduce yourself and name your organization.
Hi, this is Melody Madden. I'm with Phelps Dodge and looking at phytostabilization. I'm wondering about the water consumption used within the trials, being that we're looking at an arid environment here. Were you able to stay consistent with what would actually be out in the field?
So that's another great question and something we've been struggling with a little bit. In the greenhouse studies, the plants are clearly overwatered for an arid or semi-arid environment. Pot studies are a little bit difficult to try and limit the water on because the tailings or soil in the pot sort of cracks and the water kind of flows around it and you're not getting good water distribution. However, on the San Pedro, the Boston Mill site, we hand water those plants. Each transplant got 44 liters over the first 8 months, and at that point we stopped watering the plants. And so that was actually... we actually had a very precise measure of the water that we put on those plants, as well as the local rainfall in the area. That's a great question because not enough has been done to look at that, and to look at how long do you have to water plants in order to get them to establish.
So you can assume that you would have to water them to get them established, to really get them established.
In my opinion, you are going to have to water them for some period of time unless you get really lucky in planting them just at the beginning of the rainy season. So again, for the Boston mill site, for the seeding that we did last summer and again this summer, we are not watering.
Okay.
We are counting only on the monsoon rains. And I have to say that even though we had the rain event last summer that washed out the uphill half of the tailings, the downhill half actually has a lot of our plants growing now. And some of them are probably about 6 to 8 inches in height already. So there's some promise even without water amendments. However, the Boston Mill site, recall, is the least disturbed of all these tailings.
Okay. Well, that makes me think, you know, you talked about moving the plants out of a flood zone, basically. Or out of the tailings, just relocating them. Is there a structure that could possibly be built to minimize the effects of this flash flooding, the hard pounding rain, possibly?
Yeah.
So they're still getting some water or benefit from the environment, but they don't get washed away.
Through the use of berming, you can not only help prevent water erosion, but you can actually maximize the catchment of the natural water that actually falls on and around the tailings. So absolutely, if you have heavy equipment out there, you can do a lot to prevent erosion and trap water for the plant.
That kind of brings me to another question. As you're out here using equipment on the tailings and you're disturbing them, you are possibly creating dust that might possibly be depositing on what you've already planted. Is that going to affect them
no.
at all?
No.
Okay.
No.
Okay, let me read another question from one of our internet participants, although they did not give me their name. Once preferred vegetation is established and soil health improves, volunteer plant species will start to grow. Is it necessary to test metals uptake in volunteer species and control those that accumulate metals in shoots and leaves?
Absolutely. I tried to mention that at the very end. That's another great question that is going to take some time to answer. What our working hypothesis is that the initial plants that you put in are going to help precipitate the metals into non-plant bioavailable forms. And thus, the volunteer plants that come in at some later point will not take them up. But that hypothesis has to be tested, and I think it has to be done over, like I said, the long term, 5 to 10 years. Great question.
Okay, I've got exactly 3 o'clock, since we've got some more questions, I believe, let's go ahead for a few more minutes with some questions. I'll stay with the phone, folks. Please take your phone off mute and introduce yourself and name your organization. Okay, we'll go back to the internet participants. This is from Arcadio Rodriguez Prado, the Saskatchewan Research Council. Is there a relation or a symbiosis established between the type of bacteria found and the type of plants used?
That's another great question, and I'm going to have to say yes. I believe that there probably is, but not enough is known about that yet. Those are questions that we're looking at as well. Using some of these advanced molecular techniques looking at DNA makes these questions much more easy to address. And let me also add that I'll be happy to take questions either by phone or by email subsequent to this risky seminar.
Good point. And I'll mention that Dr. Mayer's contact information is on the seminar homepage. So if you think of another question you would like to submit to her, please do so. Okay, let's try a couple more questions here. This is from Joe Kukuza, Amira International in Melbourne, Australia. Is there any thought about using plants from different parts of the U.S. that could be substantially more efficient at phytostabilization? That is, plants not indigenous to the immediate area.
Generally, not. Especially in some of the more environmentally sensitive areas, the land managers really want to focus on species that can be considered native to that area. Also, taking plants from another part of the U.S. and trying to put them somewhere where they're not native, generally they don't survive as well without additional resources.
That leads very nicely into this question from Cecilia Horner with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in Albuquerque. As your field trials continue, have you noticed invasive non-native species taking over the planted areas and displacing the native plantings?
That's a great question, too. In the Boston Mill site, we have something called pigweed that comes for a short bloom after we have rain and then disappears again. So it did it last summer, and it's doing it again this summer. So I haven't yet worked on these sites for a long enough period of time to answer that question absolutely, but I think we will definitely see volunteer plants coming in, and some of them probably will survive longer than the pigweed seems to survive. Actually, we should take some pigweed samples and look at metal accumulation. We haven't done that yet either.
Okay, let me check back with the phone participants. If anyone has thought of a question, you can take your phone off mute and ask your question. I don't want to cut anyone off, but we've only got another moment or so. Let me read one more question from Ellen at UC Davis. Will you be doing work trying to evaluate the benefits derived from using older plants that might have better survivability, barring transplant shock?
You mean older transplants?
Yes, I believe that's what she's asking.
Actually, to transplant is a fairly expensive way to go. What we are trying to do now is to optimize the use of seeds and seeds coated with inocula, plant growth promoting bacteria, rather than use transplants. Transplants do work, however, and the age of the transplants in the few sites that I've worked on and seen doesn't seem to overwhelmingly matter. They seem to survive fairly well.
Dr. Mayer, I'd like to thank you again for today's presentation and for staying around for a few extra questions. I've got about 3:06 right now. I think this is a good time to go ahead and end today's seminar. As those of you that are still with us, Dr. Mayer offered generously to continue answering questions. Her contact information is on the seminar homepage if you'd like to send her an email. I'd also like to mention the feedback form, and I invite you to please fill out the feedback form and give us feedback on today's seminar as well as other seminars put on by the SBRP in the Risky Learning Seminar Series. With that, Monica, do you have any final thoughts?
Nope, I'm good. Thank you to everyone who participated.
Okay, thanks to you, and also thanks to Mike Gill out in Region 9 who has been helping put these together, and special thanks to Dr. Raina Mayer, today's presenters. today's presenter. And with that, I think we'll go ahead and close down. Thank you.